Good day once again to those who are here this morning. To those who are not, nice to see you. It's actually quite wondrous when you think of the multitude of things that we could have been doing right now. And each of us chose Zen's radical non-duality. Which is what we do when we sit. It's also what Zen teaches us and points to is this crucial non-duality, which when we experience it changes our experience of the world, of our lives, of our relationships, of others. And Zen is one of the many ways to approach it, this non-duality. Because usually in our lives, we're engaged with duality, differences, separations. I read something interesting recently about this notion of discrimination, what we can think of as egocentric discrimination. Because whenever we're engaged in separation, when we're not seeing or experiencing non-duality, it's due to our thinking, discriminating mind, which is a manifestation of our attachment to ourself. So in Japanese, in Zen, they call this mumyo, which literally translates as no light. When we engage in egocentric discrimination. And I read a Japanese master who said, in Christianity, we call this original sin. And I thought, what does he mean by that? And he explained that separation that's based on egocentric patterns is the source of all evils, of what we call suffering in our practice, right? In Christianity, they choose to call it evils. But so the original sin is egocentric discrimination. And he gives the example of Adam and Eve when they bite the apple and then they hide, they cover themselves with from shame. And he says shame or hiding is an instant reveals instantly that there is a wall separating self from others because there's something to hide. If we are not separate, if we're experiencing Zen's radical non-duality, we have nothing to hide. And we also will not hurt others, hurt ourselves, engage in harmful, or as we've been saying, unwholesome practices. So in thinking about all of this, I was talking yesterday with Lisa about Bernie Glassman's street retreats. And I think there's at least one person on this screen who has done a street retreat, and it's Manon, right? I think you. Tu as fait une retraite de rue, hein, Manon, hein, je crois. Oui. And all of Bernie Glassman's teachings and his practice was always pointing towards an experience of Zen's radical non-duality. That was the point. And he didn't care if it was on a cushion, if it was on the streets, if it was at Auschwitz, if it was during a Christian mass, didn't matter. The point was non-duality, experiencing oneness, non-duality. So after I had that conversation with Lisa, I remembered this little video that I had seen about the street retreats and about Bernie. And I would like to share it with you today. It's only about 10 minutes long. It's in English. I don't think there's any subtitles. I hope that's okay. I hope I can share my screen, Lisa? Yeah. So we'll see if this works.
In Yonkers, across the street from the Zen Community House is an old schoolhouse which has stood empty for over 20 years. When the number of participants during the months of training becomes too high, the school is used as a place for meetings and meditation. For some, the noisy street and public exposure are not easy to take. Today, however, we will all be taking a plunge together, as Bernie calls it. A plunge into the streets of New York with no money and only the clothes on our backs, to live homeless for 1 week in the vastness of this city.
Okay, welcome everybody. This is one of the largest street retreats in terms of starting off. What we are doing is we are going to live in the streets for a few days. It's been my experience that you will learn a lot from the streets, and that it's hard to know beforehand what it is that you're going to learn from. So I always like to say that the biggest teacher is going to be the unknown, that which we have no expectations of, or something will arise which will teach you. So just be open to the streets, open to the people. That's the point of doing this, is to go and be open to what will arise. Meandering is highly recommended. Collecting of redeemable cans and bottles and panhandling is encouraged and required, at least for some time of the retreat. You don't have to be panhandling all the time, but I would like everybody to panhandle some times. Let me go a little over the schedule. We will walk from here to Central Park, and tonight we'll sleep at Central Park. It's supposed to rain after midnight, so we'll deal with that when we get there. A number of years ago, I went into the streets to live for a few days with, and some students came with me, some people came with me. And it turned out to be very important for all of us. And in reflection, I feel that entering or plunging into parts of life which I'm afraid of or have been avoiding create a wholeness inside of myself. I bear witness to those parts that I've been rejecting or not looking at. And as they come back, I become stronger and more vibrant. They become very important practices for me. And so I've invited other people to do that, and they've been important for them. I look at it as a practice, just like Zazen is a practice. And because my experience has been so positive, I keep doing it, inviting people to do it.
Andre! Where are my people? Thank you.
people that have come, gone onto, into the streets with me, and also to the other types of plunges like Auschwitz retreat, I think have become more sensitive and have been changed into feeling, experiencing, and understanding parts of life which they didn't quite understand before, which they saw, but they really, they didn't know how to deal with them. And just like if I didn't see my hands, once I see my hands, I learn how to use them. I'm different. I can do different things. I now can take care. So the people that have gone with me on the streets can't look at street people the same way. Something changes. And I believe almost everyone that's gone with me now has more of a kinship or a feeling towards somebody on the streets. That's me.
A few months later, a street retreat in Cologne, Germany. Whenever Bernie Glassman is on tour, whether giving talks, Zen sesshins, or workshops, he tries to make these plunges possible. It doesn't matter where it is in the world. The daily schedule is structured, with the exception of possible surprises. The group splits up. People are on their own, and twice a day they come together again for prayer and meditation at a specified place. No one has brought money. The soup kitchens need to be found. Some go panhandling, a huge challenge for most. In general, it may be said that few people are ready to share this adventure with Roshi Glassman. Solidarity among the homeless is quite strong. Food or a soup kitchen are soon found. To find a place to sleep proves more difficult, especially as a whole group. Weather is an essential factor. In New York, it began to rain, and it didn't let up for 20 hours. Subways and train stations were the only places of refuge. Clearly, here in Cologne, the trouble will be the nightly temperature drop. The first autumn frost has already arrived. The group has steadily grown. Several Zen friends from Paris joined, and people from the newspaper and radio come along for a day. A day on the street, begging and looking for food with Zen master Bernie Glassman.
That means that right now,
das bedeutet, dass gerade jetzt,
each one of us needs to take the ingredients of their life.
Jeder von uns die Zutaten seines Lebens nehmen muss.
Make a meal of it.
Daraus eine Mahlzeit bereiten.
Take a bite of the meal.
Ein Stück davon abbeißen.
And offer it to others.
Und es den anderen anbieten.
So the book is about that.
Darüber geht es.
In my experience of meeting people.
In der Erfahrung der Treffen mit Leuten.
I've met wonderful, wonderful people that never heard of Zazen.
Habe ich ganz, ganz wundervolle Leute getroffen, die niemals von Zazen gehört.
Who lead the enlightened life that one would have thought if they were Buddhist and conditioned to thinking that only Buddhists can do that kind of thing, would have thought that you had to do Zazen to do that.
Das heißt, er hat also Leute getroffen, die keinen Zazen gemacht haben, von denen Buddhisten, wenn sie die gesehen hätten und deren Praxis gesehen hätten, geglaubt hätten, dass sie Buddhisten sein müssten, um diese Praxis haben zu können. So.
Yeah.
I'm very interested in a spirituality that goes beyond particular institutions. So I'm interested in people coming to an awakening to the oneness of life and the independence of life, but not necessarily any particular form. So my emphasis would be, is there orientation? Are there things going on which help people realize this oneness? It could be through Zen, it could be through different religions, it could be in different ways.
Thank you for watching. I think I'd like to open it up, and if people would like to say anything, questions or comments or Catherine? You're muted.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Yeah. Was that Joa in one of those shots in Cologne? No, because I saw a young guy with no hair and I was just wondering. More generally, what I really loved about that was it was a bit of a complicated phrase, but the idea that it's just being open to the wonders of life and being so in a way that is as open as possible, so that you're not saying you have to be this or you have to be that to see it. You just have to be open.
I think Manon had her hand up.
I wanted to say, I think it's a bit hard to say in English, but I try. What struck me at most in the street retreat in Paris is that I didn't feel really different, or I didn't feel excluded from the world. Je m'excluais pas moi-même du monde, but I felt like the way that the people looked at me gave this impression that this is from what I suffered the most, the way the people looked at me or didn't look at me.
That's what almost everyone says when they've done a street retreat, is that as soon as they put on the old clothes and walk in the street and are among the homeless, people don't even see them, or they look at them, like you say, in a completely different way. So does that mean that you now look at people in the street differently, having been there, or?
Yes.
Yeah.
Actually, I feel more they're not different at all. Mm. And I think it I didn't feel this way before this street retreat, because you always had the impression they did something wrong to be on this place, and there's something different, but there's not. And this is, yeah, what I felt very, it was a very strong feeling in the street retreat to feel, oh, okay, but there's actually nothing different. Yeah.
Debbie. We can't hear you.
This was something we were talking about this summer at the retreat in Portugal as well, also in terms of Bernie. And my own experience, now that I've seen this, I have a lot of reserves about this retreat. But I might do it, actually, having just rethought it. But my own experience was working with Michel Roche at La Villette in Paris, feeding, 500, 600 hungry, homeless. There was absolutely no control. They didn't need to show an ID card or proof of anything. Just about 550 people showed up on Sunday morning. And we generally ate with them. And I think what amazed me, there were two things that really struck me. One was that the young ones, in any case, there was a whole group of young men from Afghanistan. They were so upbeat. They were always in a good mood. And one of them told me that they'd been walking for about 3 years to get here to get to France from Afghanistan, but they're no worse for wear. They were all kind of jolly and they were gonna have a good meal and everything. And the other thing that really, I remember, and it was years ago, there were two people who had lived on the street who were also volunteers, Christian, and I think his name was Hervé. It was funny, they were both very short and they were kind of a couple at some point. And Christiane was 50 some odd. She didn't know her age. And she did know her birth date, and she'd say her birth date and say, "So how old does that make me?" And she lived in the metro and on the street for about 2 years. She was hardy, but. And when I listened to her in the beginning, I was probably a little bit resistant. She wasn't real clean and she was obviously didn't know how to read and write and stuff. But after a while, when I thought of the fact that she had survived 2 years on the street, I don't think I could make a night. I think I would have a heart attack from fear of one night in the streets of Paris. First of all, how do you sleep? And as I grew to know her and think about her experience, my respect for her was just, I was amazing to think what she had lived through. And she was pretty upbeat too, actually. I mean, she wasn't depressed and she wasn't grouchy. Wow.
Thank you. So I think that's interesting that we can, so this is an example of not going into the streets, but of meeting people where they are in another context. So meeting them in a soup kitchen, right? And what our challenge as Zen students is, if we really practice Zen's radical non-duality, is meeting each person we meet where they are. Of course, this is really difficult. And yet that's when we say sentient beings are numberless, that's what we mean, is that each person, can we meet, I vow to meet each person where they are, is basically it. So Bernie used these, you know, extreme situations. I don't know if he were still alive today, I'd be curious to know what he would be doing now, because he changed so many times in his life. But that for the past, you know, for the last, 30 years of his life, that's what he did, was create these, or not even create so much, but go into situations, like he said, that he feared or that he didn't understand, or that he saw needed some, people were hungry, as he would say, needed help, and he didn't, there was no clear way how to do it, but he would plunge into the situation and see with whatever ingredients there were. And that's the basic Zen teaching, really. He just interpreted it. You know, you can find that teaching in Dogen. This was Bernie's modern day interpretation of it, which, as you hear me, you've heard me talk, and then you hear Bernie talk, you can tell I'm very influenced by my experience of studying with Bernie. But he was just saying what I already was experiencing. It was just a different way of phrasing it. So, you know, we don't have to go in the street. Personally, I've never done a street retreat because for my various reasons, I couldn't. I had children and a job and whatever. I never could make the time to do it. However, I've done other plunges with Bernie and I know the value of it. But sitting on your cushion is also a plunge. Can we approach that as going into the street, plunging into this not knowing on the cushion? I do want to give everyone a chance to say something though about what Bernie said or something. Joa?
Yes, hello everyone. First of all, I was so moved by seeing Bernie and Bernie speaking. It's been so much part of our lineage and my life, and it was so moving, and I could recognize also a lot of the people around him, so that was very moving. The second thing, as you mentioned, all the various practices that he developed, and I was thinking, as it struck me as the film went on, that I thought, God, he's the first successor of Maizumi, and very early on he started to be really, really, really creative with the practices, and he just didn't stick to the way he was trained in, and such an inspiration. I keep thinking how we need to find strategies, practices, being creative in practices that could help us seeing this oneness, and it's an ongoing process. And the last thing, I've never done a street retreat, and watching the film, just I remember that I had many opportunities, and I felt very scared to do it. It felt more. I did the Bearing Witness retreat in Auschwitz, and for some reason, Auschwitz felt for me more comfortable than being on the street. So I never did it. I was afraid of it, and if I'm honest, I think I would be still afraid. I would still fear to do it. And if I ask myself the question, what? Because he said, you know, going where the fear is, and then you get out more vibrant if you really bear witness to that. I'm not sure. One thing that comes up for me right now would be being in a situation of vulnerability where I absolutely, vitally need help from others, and I'm not autonomous. I think that's just the idea of begging for money is difficult. I find it extremely difficult. Just that thought is, I find it very difficult. On top of the fact that I feel, oh my God, those moral issues, that ideas that I might have about, I don't need to beg for money, so why would I go in the streets when others really need it, and I take the money from others, and then I start to get into all kinds of ideas. but the vulnerability of asking for help and not having other options, I think that still is a fear that I have.
Yeah, thanks, Joa. And I think anyone, including Bernie, who has done a street retreat has had exactly those same reservations that Joa just expressed. And I know I've talked to a lot of them, and there was a panel not so long ago where some of them expressed it, that how frightened they were, how many reservations they had about it. I know that Paco, one of Bernie's successors, I don't know, somebody, Joa or Debbie, did you ever meet Paco? No, maybe not. Who is Hispanic. And he said, you know, as a person of color, I was really offended by the idea of a street retreat. And that my brothers and sisters who are, you know, submitted to this because of the culture and the society, I really thought, no, there's no way. And also in terms of security, he said, you know, in the South Bronx in 1997, when they did that, crime was really bad. And he was afraid. And he said, sometimes he even had a bodyguard to go to his car, you know, from his office. But then Bernie said, you know, Paco, I think you're overthinking this. Can you just let go of your thoughts? So he did it. He did it, Paco. And he did many, 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 he was in one of those pictures. He did many, many retreats after that. And he realized how much it changed his life. He said he had, when his son turned 18, he brought him on a street retreat as a, you know, rite of passage. And that his son is now like 35 or 40. And it was a transformative experience for his son. And he still talks about it to this day. It's important to acknowledge all these fears we have and all these thoughts we have about it. And same thing at Auschwitz. You know, we go to Auschwitz and we sit out there all day for 5 days. Well, it's nothing like with those people who were shipped there, stripped of their humanity, and then, you know, worked to death or put in a, you know, gas to death experienced. It's true. It's true. Nothing like it. And yet, absolutely transforming. Sitting on your cushion for 30 minutes doing nothing is, okay, it's fake. Because you're going to get up from your cushion and you're going to go out and do a lot of stuff. And there's a lot of stuff you have to do. And yet that 30 minutes of it can be transformative, of just sitting there, putting everything down, just sitting. Coming back. Lisa?
Thanks for showing this. It's very moving. I think the retreat you went to, Manon, was the one I had wanted to go to or thought I could go to, and then I had heard about it very, very late, so I couldn't get myself organized, and just a week before, 10 days, and it was too short notice, and then also my partner didn't want me to go. He was afraid. I was afraid as well. I don't know if I would have actually done it, but had I organized it in advance, what we're saying here, and you'll never be able, you'll never be a homeless, and you know, and you're coming back in a week, and it's you'll never be able to know what it is. But at the same time, I have this sort of, it's something that scares me, and I'm drawn to it. And because I feel this very strong connection, and also I think it's also due, and some, most of you know, I have a my brother is handicapped, schizophrenic, and I know that if we weren't there, he could be one of these person in the street. And that's something that's very frightening in a way. And so I don't know, I have this need to connect, and at the same time, I know I'm not doing it. To connect and to recognize the other and the and myself in the other. So and also like most of us, I guess, and I sometimes move away from people because I just don't want to be, you know, ask for money, or but sometimes I know I also force myself to look and smile. So it's a huge unknown, and it's and for me it's something that I at some point I am gonna have to do it. Well, thank you. So thanks for sharing this.
Well, it's partly from our conversation last night that led me to it. It's also that it's really an inspiring practice, but I get, once again, Bernie himself doesn't draw a line and say, it's only this way that you can do it. It's everything you do can be a practice like that. But it's just that these extreme things force us to like really enter in places that scare us, and we lose a lot of our attachments, you know, by force. We're kind of forced to and open. We're forced to open. So that's why Zen retreats too are good, because it's like this intense plunge, and you don't eat the food you want to eat. You don't eat when you want to eat. You don't sleep enough. You don't have enough caffeine. You have to let go. And that's why what these, like Joa said, you know, so Bernie was the first successor of Maizumi Roshi, who was, you know, like Orthodox Zen from Japan. And for 30 years of his life, Bernie, you know, for a big portion of his practice, he did that. He did the whole thing, you know, he was like Mr. Samurai Zen. Like really, really intensely Orthodox Zen guy. And then he, like Joa said, you know, he went off. He tried to do a similar type thing, and very quickly he realized it was not, he bought this big mansion, and he was gonna have this amazing Zen center like in Los Angeles, and have all these people living there and create monks and all that stuff. And very quickly he realized, no, it was not it. You know, that there were like right in the suburb next door, there were all these people starving, and it was AIDS and drug addicts, single mothers who couldn't work because they had no childcare, all this horrible stuff, you know. And he realized, this is absurd. What am I doing? You know? So he sold the mansion and changed his practice. I would not say he stuck to, however, what he had trained in. He didn't stick to the forms, but he stuck to the essence of the Zen practice of not knowing, of non-duality, of compassion. He really stayed true to his Zen practice. However, it's not what people thought Zen should be. And so a lot of people left him, and it was very controversial. And Maizumi Roshi, to his credit, didn't interfere. He let Bernie do it. Not that he could have stopped him, but he didn't, you know, say, if you do that, I will disown you, or, you know, whatever. He's okay, you know. He trusted him. He knew that Bernie, whatever Bernie would do was Zen. Was, like he said, whatever. The important thing was to look and see, are there practices that lead us to an experience of oneness, the oneness of life? the one we best know is sitting on our cushions. And then we also have koan study, which is another approach. But really, every moment, like we said about Joshu's gates, you know, 84,000 Dharma gates. Every single moment is a gate to experience the radical non-duality of Zen. And it is inspiring, as someone said, I think it was Joa, those retreats were in 97 that were filmed, you know, and since then, so that's 25 years ago, and they're still going on. There's still street retreats all over the US, sometimes in Europe, not so many in Europe, but there are some in Europe. Many of those people who we saw in the video, Joa said, you know, he recognized some of the people, they're still there and they're still doing it. And we saw Geno Roshi and Michelle Dubois in Cologne. And they said that after that retreat, that's what inspired them to start the soup kitchen that still exists today, L'un et l'autre. And so many of those people have gone on to do street retreats themselves, or, you know, other practices that they've continued on this way of radical non-duality. In other words, that's it. Heinz Jürgen, who was translating into German, I just saw him in June when I was at the White Plum meeting in Germany. He's still there, you know, he's still doing it. I don't think he does street retreats, but he's still there.
I have to say, for me, I mean, I haven't, as I said, I haven't done the street retreat, but I've done the bearing witness in Auschwitz, and it was one of the most transformative experience I've ever had in a retreat. And I think it's linked to the fact that it's so intense. It goes so much where the fear is. It put us in such a situation that was just so huge that really great doubt, great awakening. And it really pulls down to that. And it was impossible when sitting in one of the houses where the prisoners were staying and spending the night there, just not going out of that experience, just feeling nothing happened. It was too huge. So it was very helpful. And obviously the going where the fear is and going it really intensely is really the as Bernie says afterwards, people are more sensitive and more vibrant. I mean, I experienced that for myself in the bearing witness in Auschwitz. You're muted.
Voilà. Can I tell a Bernie anecdote, jokes kind of thing? Apparently, Bernie smokes big stogie cigars. And he had a student of his, I don't know what nationality, who found this quite reprehensible. And now, how did it go? I don't want to get this backwards. Oh, no, the student said to Bernie, "Would you trust a Zen master who smokes cigars?" And Bernie said, "No." And the guy left, apparently. burning stage.
But yes, we see him in the film with the cigar.
Another thing that I find inspiring is, yeah, following on Debbie's comment, seeing him with his shirts and doing all these great, just the look and just going off the off track from the representation we have of what Zen Master is, and also seeing him trying to find a way in that, and also what he said at the end with reaching out to other traditions, also to people that practice in other traditions. And yet he's definitely a Zen teacher. And for me, it's also an inspiration. It's like how to balance that, how to maintain that lineage, that thread, and yet still be open to the modern world, develop practices that fits the situation and so on. So that's also very inspiring.
Maybe it's a Catholic upbringing I had. I went to a Catholic school when I was a kid. And I remember learning that we were all the same. And I pretty much took that to heart. And I remember being about college age when I looked at a wino in the metro and realized for the first time, I remember having the thought that could have been me, but that will never be me. And it was a kind of a realization and a decision that my path had taken a different way. And I'm trying to understand what radical non-duality is. Because I was even thinking, I certainly when I think about it, I definitely don't have whatever it is, or don't am not what whatever it is. And at the same time, I'm thinking, well, maybe when you take everything at the first degree, as I did as a kid, maybe that was radical non-duality.
Yeah, I think that the intellect can't understand radical non-duality. So maybe, as you say, as a child, we have a better chance of experiencing it. And probably, I think we do. You know, I think children have no problem seeing the oneness, experiencing the oneness of things. But then very quickly, because society requires it too, we have to just create all kinds of separations. But the point being that the intellect can't understand radical non-duality or infinity or limitlessness, something like that, we could say. And even when we say infinite, our intellect tends to think of it as, so there's something that's finite and something that's infinite. So, but that's not what we're talking about, because as soon as we say that, then that means infinity has a boundary that doesn't include what is limited. So when we talk about, you know, radical non-duality, it's this non-separation that transcends separation and non-separation, something like that. So, you know, in a sense, when you say you see this, you know, the guy in the, you know, the SDF in the metro, at the time we didn't call them SDF. I think it was in French, we said clochard. or wino in English, or bum, you know. But when, so when you say you see it and you have this realization that it could have been you, in a sense, that's part of the acknowledgement that it is you, but that it's manifesting in a different way. You know, as Bernie said, and he was almost, you could almost see he was quite moved, Bernie, when he said that, you know, that people, when they go in the streets and they have a different experience and they see people and they say, that's me. That's me. Of course, it's not. You know, you're not sitting there on the metro bench with a bottle of wine, you know, really bad wine too, probably. And, but that's you in the sense that we are all one. It's just another manifestation of you. That's, you know, I'm using intellectual words to say it, but it can only be experienced. And that's why Bernie throws us into these extreme things to experience it. You know, Joe was talking about Auschwitz. When I went to Auschwitz, it was the first one, it was 96. And there were these, you know, so we learned a lot. I mean, I didn't realize at the time that there had been, you know, like political communists, that there had been what we call gypsies or Hom, who had been sent there. I also didn't realize that gay people had been sent to Auschwitz. And I mean, I probably had heard that, but I didn't really think about it. And in our group of 150 people, there were some gay people. And they chose to go into the barracks where the gay people had been held because they were kept separate. It's absurd, right? That they, even within the people that they want to get rid of and eliminate, they're separating them, you know, but. So they spent the whole retreat there. They slept there. They were with us during the day practicing, but that's where they spent their time. And they decided to sew these little pink triangles out of some cloth they found or something. I don't know where they got the cloth, but these pink triangles, and they gave them to all of us. And it was really, it was, you know, a reference to the yellow stars. Now, I don't know if did the gay people actually have to wear pink triangles during the Nazi regime? I don't think so, but anyway. Anyway, so they gave them to us, and actually almost everyone put them on and wore them during the week. And it was really, it was little things like that that we experienced at Auschwitz, as well as huge things, you know, of experiencing, you know, suffering. And I imagined, I had this really powerful experience. My son was not even a year old at the time when I went. And I met when we were doing a practice around the ruins of the crematorium. It was so powerful. We've been there for days. And I had this vivid image of myself going down into that crematorium with my kids. My daughter was 7 and my son was not even a year old, and carrying them down because we were going to be, it wasn't the crematorium, it was the place where people were gassed. Taking them with all of these other people, the children would have been terrified. I would have been terrified, but what would I have done with my children? You know, how would I have experienced that with my children? It's that kind of thing that going into these extreme circumstances helps us to eliminate those separations that we make and experience the radical non-duality, you know.
And following up on that, and to follow up on what Catherine is doing, for me also it had to do with, it was so huge that the rational mind had to stop. There was something about there was something I just couldn't grasp from an intellectual level, and this is where for me it shifted. That rational mind stopped. All the comments in my head stopped.
And I repeat that we can do this in any situation. As some of you know, that's why I went to work with the refugees in Paris a few years ago. It was because, like what Joa says, the rational thought and the intellect could not grasp it. It made no sense that all of these, you know, thousands, millions of people are being forced from their homes and we're telling them they can't come here. I could not grasp it mentally, intellectually. So I went to work at the refugee center. And that's what it is, you know, as Joa said, it's the rational mind, just or the intellect, the discriminating mind, whatever we want to call it. It can't understand. It has other wonderful qualities, that mind. But as we were saying when I talked about the queen, you know, can we put those wonderful qualities of the thinking mind to the service of radical non-duality and the qualities of that? Compassion, wisdom, tolerance, patience, love. Instead of putting that thinking mind to the service of hate, destruction, accumulation, aggression, violence.
It was very beautiful to feel Bernie Glassman, to feel alive, seeing, not only hear about him. And the conversation is too difficult for me to speak in English. But it reminds me a short scene that in a documentary from an old artisan in Portugal, an artisan who worked with ceramic and big tomes for wine and olives. He writes also poetry. And something that I write here because I found this so beautiful. He wrote, "Can we put some poetry between these little moments we have? Entre gagner la vie et la mort. Entre gagner la vie et la mort, je ne sais pas dire en anglais. May we put some poetry between, may we be able to put some poetry between the notre fonction, notre gagner la vie et not our death." I don't know, it's perhaps not so good to understand. I don't know if José, you can help me, José, to translate?
I think everybody understood. Okay. That's my feeling.
Okay.
So this is basically is to write, to put some poetry, to locate poetry between our acting life and our death. That's basically our professional life, what we do and death.
For me, it raises the question, is there something different between in poetry, putting poetry and just putting awareness?
I think, yeah.
Maybe a poet in the online can answer that.
But I sense that that's similar to, you know, in that sense, poetry being experiencing the oneness of life. You know, can we, in the middle of all of this stuff we have to do, and in of our limited existence, because we know that we will die, can we still experience the poetry, the beauty, the perfection, the oneness of life? That's how I hear it.
Thank you.
What you just said, Amy, about using intelligence, to do the proper thing, the appropriate answer to life. I'm sorry, I was late again somehow. I thought it was at 11. Half past 11. So I saw a little bit of the movie, of the documentary, and what impressed me was this. What were the eyes of Benny Glassman? You really can see that those eyes were expressing his deep love. That was what touched me. But anyway, what I wanted to say about what your reference to the fact that people can use their minds for both things. Lately, I've been reading again and seeing a lot of David Bohm's. There's a lot of stuff on the internet. David Bohm was this quantum physic, someone that I think I tried to share. I suggest you to see the documentary Infinite Potential on him. And the more I know about him, it's the more I become surrendered to his, intelligent compassion. Or he was a very, very promising theorist, physicist. He was a disciple of Einstein and all that, but. To give a moment in his life, and that must have had to do also with his suffering and with his quest, he became very much interested in studying, not so much studying, but exploring consciousness. And one of the things that he was advocating was that people should come together to speak, to dialogue. It was the very first. I mean, he was not in any way someone that was religiously bound to a certain practice. He discovered out of his own quest, and then he became very much interested in Krishnamurti thought, and there's a lot of talk with Krishnamurti. But you can also see that man, out of his own intelligence, and he was quite intelligent, was a brilliant physicist. He understood that the main problem of one's, of human life in general is thinking. So he was trying to explore how we can live together using our intelligence, not to split. In fact, he's talking always about the problem of fragmentation. And somehow he must have had some kind of deep experience to understand this wholeness. And he's speaking a lot about that. And trying to do in his own field in his own field of research, trying to find out how people could come together, and not really giving some kind of directions, but to lead people to explore what we are doing, what we are thinking, what we are doing with our lives. In a way, it's very Zen, the kind of practice that he was advocating. But this is only to say this, it's true that we all have different resources, and the question is to know how to use them. So that's all I want to say.
Yeah, thank you. I did watch that documentary. You sent me the link, I think.
Yeah.
And
it's so, but lately I've been watching, because he has many things on the internet. And actually, at the end of his life, one year or 2 years, he used to sit with people and he made kind of seminars on consciousness. And they're very interesting because it's more this kind of interaction between someone. He's not giving, he's himself exploring with the people that he sits with. This fundamental question about how to use our mind, how to use our mind creatively from this place of wholeness and not from our common way of reasoning. And actually, he really thought that he died in 1992 or 1993, something like that. And he has a very, in the end, he says either we change, either humankind is able really to shift into this inclusive way of being and reasoning, or then we have no future, in fact. It's in a way very pessimistic.
Well, but this is what we're talking about about non-duality. We call it radical non-duality. He calls it, holistic or non-fragmented. So can we act from that place instead of from separation? That's the challenge of Zen, and that's the point. Yeah. That's also the beauty of Zen, actually, because it's so simple. It's this radical, simple non-duality. We are out of time, people. I'm sorry. Thank you really for participating and sharing this. There's still a lot of his Bernie's teachings are alive and well. They're, his successors are continuing it all, and I'm still a member of the Peacemakers, which I was helped found in the old days, but. So, if you're interested in any of it, so just ask me. And I know that there's someone in Portugal who has been really trying to get a street retreat going there. Because I can't lead it, having never done it, I will have to bring my Dharma brother, Frank, I think, he's done street retreats a lot. There's another guy, a Brazilian guy in Switzerland, who also leads them. And he might be good in Portugal because he could speak Portuguese. So anyway, thank you. We will meet again at 5:30. 6:30 Paris time, I think, right? However, Lisa cannot be the timekeeper. Is there anyone who could volunteer to do that?
Dale has kindly volunteered.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Dale. Yeah, thank you very much. So we'll be back. Have a nice afternoon. Try to stay with your practice and this radical non-duality, whatever you do. Claudia is asking something, I think.
Yeah, Amy, is there any way I can see the film after?
I can send you the link. It's actually part of a bigger panel, so, but yeah, I can try to figure it out, yeah.
But to you, are you going to send it to me by mail right now?
No, I can, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
I'll try to, I'll see if it works.
Okay, and if you can't manage. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. You have to stop the recording, Lisa. Huh?